This is disc number two.
I was tiptoeing out of the room containing mother and nursing child and aiming myself in the general direction of the sofa bed. Mother seemed glum. "What's the matter?" I asked, not particularly caring for the answer. Out gushed a torrent of complaints about Quinn's behavior since Dixie's birth. She'd become surly with babysitters. She'd stopped sleeping through the night. She no longer ate her vegetables. She was resisting the final, crucial stages of potty training. She showed no interest in any activity except watching Shrek for the 150th time. She'd been rude to her mother when she returned from San Francisco. In the good old days, when Tabitha complained to me about Quinn, she did so in a collaborative spirit. We were joined by common interests. We were Munger and Buffett hashing out investment strategy. This didn't sound like that. This sounded more like an Arab attempting to engage an American on the subject of the Israeli army. "She's not eating her vegetables because she's pissed off about Dixie," I said. "She's not eating her vegetables because she had a huge cup of frosted mini-wheats just before dinner," she said. The frosted mini-wheats had been my idea. She didn't say that. She didn't have to. Everything about Quinn was now my idea. My wife knew this was the time in Quinn's life when she needed to be indulged, but she also had an investment to protect. "I just feel like my 2.5 years of work on her is being washed down the drain," she said. "She'll get all her good habits back once she gets used to Dixie." "Once you lose good habits, you can't get them back," she said. Never having had good habits myself, I was poorly situated to argue the point, and if I had, I wouldn't have been believed. My wife was raised in a military household that left her in full possession of the martial virtues. I was raised in a home where it was possible for me every couple of weeks to steal a jumbo sack of Nestle's chocolate chip cookies from the kitchen and secrete them under my bed at night without anyone being the wiser for it. I was meant to be 6'3" and make straight A's through high school, but as a result of skipping dinner and instead eating a dozen Nestle's chocolate chip cookies every night, I wound up 5'10" with a D in biology my sophomore year. I could see my wife's point. She had spent 2.5 years drilling her better qualities into her first child only to see them sucked out in 3.5 weeks of prolonged exposure to me. She was the ace of the pitching staff who had shut down the opposing batters for 8 innings only to watch the closer blow the game in the 9th. I've had baseball on my mind. In the past 3 years, I have tried on occasion to imagine what effects I am having on my child. I do this dutifully, rather than naturally, because it seems like the sort of thing a father should do. But I never get anywhere with it. The fact, as opposed to the theory, of life with a small child is an amoral system of bribes and blackmails. You do this for me, you get that. You don't do this for me, you don't get that. I've always assumed that if a small child has enough joy and love and stability in her life, along with intelligently directed bribes and blackmail, the rest will take care of itself. And my approach appeared to be working. Right up until the birth of her sister, Quinn excelled at childhood, and did so, it seemed, effortlessly. It honestly never occurred to me that I should be in some way shaping her. I was one of those easygoing CEOs who believed that excessive discipline crushes the creativity of his employees. I believed in managing by hanging around. In retrospect, the only reason I was able to get away with this pose is that I wasn't the CEO. I was more like a titular chairman, allowed to sit at the head of the table, but never actually listened to. Now, clearly, I must take a different approach. The CEO's attention has been diverted by a difficult acquisition in a foreign country. The chairman is, however briefly, in charge. Everyone else is anxious. The thing that most surprised me about fatherhood the first time around was how long it took before I felt about my child what I was expected to feel. Clutching Quinn after she exited the womb, I was able to generate tenderness and a bit of theoretical affection, but after that, for a good 6 weeks, the best I could manage was detached amusement. The worst was hatred. I distinctly remember standing on a balcony with Quinn squawking in my arms and wondering what I would do if it wasn't against the law to hurl her off it. I also recall convincing myself that official statistics dramatically overstated the incidence of sudden infant death syndrome when an infant dies for no apparent reason in her crib, because most of them were probably murder. The reason we all must be so appalled by parents who murder their infants is that it is so easy and even natural to do. Maternal love may be instinctive, but paternal love is learned behavior. Here is the central mystery of fatherhood, or at any rate, my experience of it. How does a man's resentment of this thing that lands in his life and instantly disrupts every aspect of it for the apparent worse turn into love? A month after Quinn was born, I would have felt only an obligatory sadness if she had been rolled over by a truck. 6 months or so later, I'd have thrown myself in front of the truck to save her from harm. What happened? What transformed me from a monster into a father? I do not know, but this time around, I'm keeping a closer eye on the process. I can't honestly say that I found Dixie, at least at first glance, quite so loathsome as her older sister. She doesn't holler so much for no reason at all, and when she does, I'm usually not around to hear it, as I'm taking care of Quinn. That's the main difference this time. I now have what her mother regards as a good excuse to avoid the unpleasantness of these first few weeks, and so I do. Occasionally, I even forget that she's there. It's a strange sensation to walk into a room, flip on the television, watch a baseball game for 20 minutes, look to your right and find a 5-week-old child you did not know was there, looking back. Still, I've been left knowingly alone with Dixie enough and been made sufficiently unhappy by her with fatigue and frustration to have felt the odd, murderous impulse. At the same time, I've already noticed in the past week or so a tendency to gaze upon her with genuine fondness. Here, as best I can determine, are the factors contributing to what appears to be another miraculous shift in feeling occurring inside me at this very moment. 1. Maternal propaganda. I'm a professional writer, and therefore am meant to be keenly observant. Without Tabitha, however, I would notice next to nothing about my own child, and certainly nothing admirable. All I'm able to see by myself are the many odd-colored substances that emerge from her that need cleaning up and the many unpleasant noises she makes that shake me from my sleep. But there are all these other more lovable things about her, too, and her mother sees every one of them and presses them upon me with such genuine enthusiasm that it thaws my frozen heart. Her facial expressions, for instance. She has her smurf face and her bowel movement face and her ET face. She has her how you doing today face, and her call me at the office face, and her mafia hitman face, which is the one when she curls her lip at you, and you half expect her to say, "You talking to me?" 2. Her gift for mimicry. A 5-week-old baby is for the most part unresponsive to ordinary attempts to communicate with her. You can scream at her, or you can sing to her, and all you'll get in return is a blank stare. But if you press your face right up close to hers and contort it into grotesque shapes, she'll copy whatever you're doing. Stick out your tongue, she'll stick out her tongue. Open wide your mouth, and she'll open wide hers, too. Lacking anything else to do when we find ourselves thrown together, we do this, and the more we do it, the more I like her. 3. Her tendency to improve with age. Already, Dixie has progressed from waking every 90 minutes and screaming at the top of her little lungs to waking every 2 hours and screaming at the top of her little lungs. While this might seem insufferable to anyone who didn't know any worse, to me it seems like extraordinary progress, an act of goodwill even. She still won't win any good citizenship awards, but she's gunning for most improved player, and it's hard not to admire her for the effort. But there's something else, too, which I hesitate to mention for fear it will be used against me the next time we divvy up the unpleasant chores around here. The simple act of taking care of a living creature, even when you don't want to, maybe especially when you don't want to, is transformative. A friend of mine, who adopted his 2 children, was asked by a friend of his how he could ever hope to love them as much as if they were his own. "Have you ever owned a dog?" he said. And that's the nub of the matter. All the little things that you must do for a helpless creature to keep it alive cause you to love it. Most people know this instinctively. For someone like me, who has heretofore displayed a nearly superhuman gift for avoiding unpleasant tasks, it comes as a revelation. It's because you want to hurl it off the balcony and don't that you come to love it. The first rule of fatherhood is that if you don't see what the problem is, you are the problem. For most of the past couple of weeks, I hadn't been able to see what the problem was. Everything had been going swimmingly. For the first time since the birth of my second child, I was able to get back properly to work. My fear that my children would starve, or at the very least, be forced to attend public school, was receding. The time I needed to earn a living had to come from someplace, of course, but it hadn't been obvious to me where in the family it should come from. Not from my wife, to whom I am addicted. Not from my eldest child, who has made it clear that she can't survive on 1 minute less of parental attention than she received before her sister was born. The only person who would be perfectly untroubled by my absence was the baby. Having worked up enough feeling for her that I could honestly say that I preferred having her around to not, I could now, in good conscience, neglect her. Sure enough, by laying Dixie off on her mother and various babysitters, I was able to slip back into something like my old routine. Within a week, I had a new book up and nearly running. All was well. And then, her mother turned up in my office with that look in her eye. I tried to head her off before she got started by telling her just how secure I was making our family's finances. She was uninterested in the family's finances. "You need to set aside time to spend with Dixie," she said. "Oh," I said, "I've spent time with her." "You just went an entire week without seeing her." "It's not like she knows." "You know," she said, which was true, sort of. "How often do you want me to see her?" "I think you should have enough material about Dixie to sustain a biweekly Slate column," she said. My first thought was, what kind of father is it who sees his child just enough to generate material for his column? My second thought was, my kind of father. In that spirit, but not only in that spirit, I took Dixie and her mother to the Parkway Theater in Oakland to see Italian for Beginners. The Parkway Theater, the greatest invention since birth control, is a cinema that on Monday nights admits only people over the age of 18, and then only if they are accompanied by people under the age of 1. 60 parents of 30 babies purchase their tickets, order their dinners, gather their glow-in-the-dark dinner claim check numbers, and head into a theater. There, seated on deep plush sofas, infants howling mightily all around them, relaxed for the first time in a week, they wait placidly for their dinners to arrive and their movie to begin. It usually does this without much warning. There aren't any previews or ads at the Parkway. Whatever they're showing just starts right up. Watching a movie with 30 babies is different than watching a movie without them. It's actually better in some ways. The babies themselves, all piled up in one place like that, are themselves worth paying to see. They tend to howl all at once, say when a character laughs raucously or a shot rings out in the night. They also tend to sleep all at once, say when a character isn't laughing or a shot isn't ringing out. Occasionally, they even perform amazing tricks. Just before the movie began, for instance, a 6-month-old girl in the front row balanced herself in midair with nothing for support but her father's unsteady palm. The whole crowd cheered. The success of an evening at the Parkway turns on the movie. There are good movies to watch with babies and bad movies to watch with babies. Italian for Beginners, odd as it may sound to anyone who has seen it, turns out to be very nearly the perfect movie to watch with babies. It opens with a firm promise to be one of those bleak Scandinavian character pieces in which every character is either dying or despairing, or both. This came as good news for us, as it seemed unlikely in the extreme that any character would laugh or that any shots would ring out in the night. Nobody needed murdering in this one. Also, there's nothing like the misery of life as presented in Scandinavian art to remind the new parent that no matter how bad he thinks he has it, some people have it even worse. Scandinavians. Without Dixie, I would have stewed in my seat, thoroughly ticked off that I'd been conned by the cheery-sounding title into sitting through an Ibsen drama. With Dixie, I was pleased to have been conned. But then something happened. Two things, actually. First, about midway through, a bleak Scandinavian character piece became a spoof on a bleak Scandinavian character piece. Everyone who needed to die died in a hurry, leaving the remaining characters to cope with their despair unaided. And toward the end of the second act, their quiet, Nordic depression took a dangerous U-turn, as all at once they discovered, as if they were thinking an original thought, what Scandinavians have known for centuries. If you want to be happy in Scandinavia, you have to go to Italy. The second thing that happened resulted directly from this shocking eruption of Scandinavian joie de vivre. Dixie woke up and began to holler. The implicit rule at the Parkway is that you can let your baby cry and enjoy the show, and no one will think any less of you. The Parkway offers the guilt-relieving sensation usually available only to smokers who find themselves surrounded by other smokers, or to fat people who find themselves seated on airplanes with other fat people. But if before you arrive at the Parkway, you've earned a reputation with your wife as a neglectful father, this sensation is no longer so easily had. Instead, you must rise and walk around with your child until she is mollified. The final scenes of the movie I glimpsed only out of the corner of my eye. A happy Scandinavian remains to me an elusive sight. The other night, Quinn and I went camping in Fairyland. Fairyland is a toddler-sized Disneyland smack in the middle of Oakland. Three times each summer, it sells tickets to about 25 parents and allows them to pitch their tents and their toddlers inside the park. For the first time in their young lives, 25 small children have a chance to spend the night under the stars, or, at any rate, the skyscrapers that loom over Fairyland. A few months ago, I mentioned to Quinn that we might do this, and she has been unable to contain herself on the subject ever since. Every other day, she has asked me, "When are we going camping in Fairyland?" or "Can we sleep in a tent today?" She's never been camping or slept in a tent and can't possibly know what any of it means. That is why she wants so badly to do it. We enter not through the main entrance, but through a gate in the back of the place between the miniature Ferris wheel and the bumper boats. 25 parents and their toddlers line up and wait for the gate to open so that they can rush in and find the softest, most level patch of grass to pitch their tents. In line are Quinn's friend Matt and his father John. John is the reason I am here. John told me about camping in Fairyland. John, who has done this once before, also told me that I didn't need to bring anything to Fairyland except a tent and sleeping bags. Fairyland would take care of the rest. But John, I notice, carries many more possessions than I do. I have only 3 large sacks. He has 8. What is in those other 5 sacks, I wonder? What does an experienced Fairyland camper bring with him that I have neglected to bring? The gates swing open and the other families rush to find the best spots in the dish-shaped campground. Quinn is more interested in the fact that she appears to have Fairyland entirely to herself, and she rushes off past the Ferris wheel to pet the donkeys. The great thing about Fairyland, from the point of view of a 3-year-old, is that it is designed with a 36-inch high person in mind. The horses on the carousel are designed for a 36-inch high person. The cars in the steam train are designed for a 36-inch high person. The long tunnel in the Alice in Wonderland section is designed for a 36-inch high person. It's a home explicitly for children between the ages of 2 and 5. Any ordinary 7-year-old is made to feel unwelcome. With one exception, it is a Lilliputian world drawn perfectly to scale. The exception is the donkeys. These large animals, which Quinn claims are llamas, are also surprisingly aggressive. I rush after her and quickly lose any chance of securing a comfortable place to sleep. By the time I herd Quinn back into the saucer, all of the soft, level places have been taken. We'll be spending the night on the hard, steep slope just below the rim. All the other fathers have their tents looking very tent-like. These are elaborate affairs, with great huge roofs and fancy walk-in entrances. The man in the tent beside me not only has his tent up and running, he has a fantastic contraption that looks like a giant fire extinguisher and sounds like a pneumatic pump. He's huffing and wheezing over the thing like a pro. He's inflating what appears to be a full-sized mattress inside his enormous tent. I do not own one of these. I have never even seen one of these. My tent is still in its sack on the ground. Quinn looks around, then at me.
Where is our tent, Daddy?
It's in there. I point to the blue sack.
Why?
I haven't put it up yet. You want to help Daddy put up the tent?
I want to go see the llamas.
A bit tensely. I need you to stay here while I put up our tent. In a flash, she's gone. One eye on the donkeys, I unravel the tent and count our possessions with the other. These are the tent and two sleeping bags I bought last week at REI, one head-mounted coal miner's flashlight that Tabitha gave me so I could see the barbecue pit when I grilled at night, three diapers, one sack of wipes, a purple and green glow-in-the-dark toothbrush, one tube of strawberry-flavored toothpaste, insect repellent, a pair of what Quinn calls my stripy PJs, along with the pink slippers she insisted she could not do without. Finally, there is a tattered and yellowing outward-bound student handbook from the last time I camped, years ago, when I spent a month wandering about a wilderness area in Oregon. In this tattered, outward-bound handbook is everything I have forgotten about camping, or so I think. When I open it, I see that it is, like Outward Bound itself, more concerned with my spiritual development than my survival. It's filled with aphorisms the Outward Bound student is meant to take to heart. They are wet with the showers of the mountains and embrace the rock for want of a shelter. Job, chapter 24, verse 8. For the first time in more than two decades, I pitch a tent. It has such an odd shape to it, I think to myself when I'm finished. John wanders over and stares a bit. It looks like one of those old Volkswagen Beetles with a tarp thrown over it, he finally says. I'm a little worried the fly sheet isn't on right, I say. He thinks about what appears to be my problem. I think you'll be okay in downtown Oakland, he says. The man in the tent next door continues to pump away at his inflatable mattress. Sweat drips from the tip of his nose. John leaves. I turn to the sweating man. So far as I can see, his giant inflatable mattress is no more inflated than it had been 20 minutes before. No longer does he seem quite the aficionado. What are you doing? I ask. He stops, relieved to have an excuse not to keep pumping away.
Trying to pump this fucking thing up, he says.
I peer into his tent at the limp mattress. How does it work? I ask.
I'm not sure, he says. My wife bought it.
Pause.
This whole thing was my wife's idea.
I sympathize, and yet, at the same time, do not. The truth is, I am pleased by his distress. It means that it is possible, just, that I am not the least prepared father for the journey that lies ahead of us. Quinn and I may not survive, but we won't be the first to go. A night in Fairyland divides fairly neatly into two dramatically different experiences. The first amounts to a rave for toddlers. The Fairyland staff lays out a buffet banquet of hamburgers, hot dogs, potato chips, and chocolate and vanilla cupcakes, food that not a single toddler can find anything to object to. Not a single vegetable, not one fruit. For the first time since I've become a father, I dine with my child, alongside other parents and their children, unaccompanied by torture chamber shrieking. All the children eat happily, greedily, so that they can scramble away as quickly as possible to the Fairyland rides, which stay open until 9 p.m. But there's more. At 8 o'clock at night, when most of them would be in bed, they attend an expertly executed puppet show. They watch The Story of Cinderella with giant sacks of popcorn on their laps and their mouths wide open. At 8:30, a woman dressed as a gypsy leads them in song. At 10 p.m., they stumble, exhausted and sated, back to their tents. There begins the second part of a night in Fairyland. About 2 years ago, addled with lack of sleep, my wife and I adopted a firmish policy not to further encourage Quinn to view the middle of the night as the most interesting part of the day. We shut the door on her at 9 p.m. and do our best not to hear or see her until 7 in the morning. And it has worked, so far as we know, though she still tends to get up a few times a week around 3 a.m. and holler at the top of her lungs. But as a result of our policy, I know next to nothing about her sleeping life. That changes this night. We crawl into the tent at 10. For the next hour, Quinn amuses herself by punching the roof and racing outside and trying to climb inside other people's tents. When even that gets old, she settles into her sleeping bag and instructs me to read her a book. 11:30 at night must feel to a 3-year-old like 4 in the morning to an adult, but Quinn lasts, along with every other child in the camp, until 11:30. During the second reading of Harold and the Purple Crayon, she falls asleep. Here is a rough log of what occurs during the next 6 hours. 12:15. Quinn pokes me in the head until I wake up.
"Wake up, Daddy! Wake up, Daddy!" she says.
"What?" I say.
"I need you to snuggle me," she says.
I curl up next to her. She falls back asleep. 1 o'clock.
"Daddy!"
I wake up and find her seated bolt upright inside the tent.
What?
I say.
"You forgot to put bug spray on me."
It's true. I apply insect repellent. She falls back asleep. 1:38.
"My sleeping bag came off."
"What?" I say.
"My sleeping bag!"
She wails. I cover her up.
"No!"
she says.
"I want your sleeping bag!"
As her sleeping bag is 4 feet long, this presents a problem. We negotiate and compromise on both of us sleeping under both sleeping bags. 3:15.
"An owl is in the tent!"
Again, she's bolt upright.
"What?"
I say, scrambling for the miner's headlamp. By the time I find it, she's fast asleep. 4:12.
"Daddy!"
I wake up. This time, she's awake, alarmingly alert and rested. I am not.
"What?"
I ask.
"Daddy, I just want to say how much fun I had with you today,"
she says. Actual tears well up in my eyes.
"I had fun with you too,"
I say. "Can we go back to sleep?"
"Yes, Daddy."
Then she snuggles right up against me for what I assume will be the long haul. 5 o'clock. The fucking birds are actually chirping. Quinn, of course, awakens with them, turns to me, and begins to sing. "There was a farmer had a dog, and Bingo was his name, oh, B-I-N-G-O, 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 and Bingo was his name, oh." "It's still sleepy time," I mutter.
"Is it time to wake up, Daddy?"
"Not yet." Miraculously, she falls back to sleep. 5:45. It's still dark outside. I wake up to find Quinn standing in her pink slippers at our tent door, which she has unzipped.
"Matt!"
she shouts.
"Are you awake?"
I hear a cry from a distant tent.
"Quinn! I'm awake! Are you awake? Matt!"
shouts Quinn again.
"I'm awake! I'm awake!"
45 minutes later, the four of us are all stumbling off to a breakfast of sugar pops. John, if anything, looks worse than I feel. And yet neither of us feels deterred. The evening went pretty much as we'd expected. "I just heard that they do this at the Oakland Zoo," he says. "When's that?" I hear myself saying. The second rule of fatherhood is that if everyone in the room is laughing, and you don't know what they're laughing about, they are laughing about you. A few months ago, when I dropped Quinn off at school, I had that peculiar fatherhood feeling of having just discovered in a crowded room that my fly was unzipped. From the moment I walked into her classroom, my mere presence seemed to remind her three lady teachers of some impossibly funny joke. They choked back giggles and turned away and pretended to be very busy organizing the dinosaurs in the sandbox and counting the graham crackers in the box. After a couple of days of this, I finally asked one of them what was going on, and while she said, "Oh, nothing," she meant, "You don't want to know." But her smile was indulgent. Whatever I had done evidently had caused no offense. I should have just let it drop. Instead, I sent in my wife to investigate. They wouldn't tell me exactly what it was, she said, when she'd returned from fetching Quinn from school. But it has something to do with something Quinn said about your... About my what? I asked. She looked pained. About my what? About your penis. That's all you can tell me? That's it. That evening, as I showered, Quinn rushed into the bathroom. This in itself wasn't unusual. It's a hobby of hers to open the shower door and spray water all over the bathroom. She likes to watch her naked father wash the soap from his eyes with one hand and prevent a flood with the other. But this time, she also had something she wanted to say.
Daddy has a small penis!
She shouted. The phrase came a bit too trippingly off her tongue. Clearly, it wasn't the first time she'd said it. I squinted down at her, menacingly, through soap bubbles. What? She took it up as a chant.
Daddy has a small penis! Daddy has a small penis! Daddy has a small penis!
As the little vixen spun out of control, I considered my options. To protest at all was to protest too much. I was as trapped as an elephant in quicksand or a politician in a gossip column. Anything I did or said in response would only make matters worse. Really, there were only two choices, silence or laughter. And so I laughed, mainly because stoicism is impossible when your three-year-old daughter is hurling insults more or less directly at your privates. I said, with what I hoped sounded like detached amusement. Sure enough, Quinn instantly lost interest in the whole subject. Surprisingly quickly, my mere presence ceased to amuse her teachers. My vanity soon recovered, as it always does, and I'd very nearly forgotten all about the incident. But then, last week, as I walked through Quinn's classroom door, the giggles resumed. I went straight to my wife. "Yes, they're all laughing at you," she said, "but it's only because of the way you dress your daughter." Since Dixie was born 3 months ago, it has been my job to dress Quinn. I had heretofore regarded my performance of this duty, and indeed any other duty I happened to perform, as little short of heroic. "How do they know I dress her?" I asked. "Because when you were out of town last week, I dressed her, and when she walked into school last week, they all said, 'Mama must have dressed you today.'" "What's wrong with how I dress her?" "Oh, please. She looks fine when I dress her. She looks like a street person." "Look," I said, pointing to Quinn's room. "There's a war in there every morning. I do the best I can." "It's a war because she knows you don't know what you're doing." You might think that I would have come away from this conversation relieved. It obviously could have been much, much worse. But a similar nerve had been struck, the one that is somehow more fully exposed in the male who must constantly defend his self and habits in a house of females. There was a time, not very long ago, when I didn't think twice of wearing the same hiking shorts for a week at a stretch, or even once of going a year wearing only the shirts that happened to be stacked on top. This was not sloth. This was not indolence. It was efficiency. A minute more spent dressing than was absolutely required was a minute wasted. In the 3 months that her appearance has been my problem, I have done my best to instill Quinn with the same ideals.
"Daddy, I'm awake!"
she screams at some bleak hour when she is the first in the house to rise. I stumble painfully over the barricades and into her room and throw clothes on her before she has a chance to wake up everyone else, too. It's true that I'm not thinking much about what clothes I'm throwing on her, but that's because she's 3 years old. She's not supposed to care how she looks, so long as she does not look wildly dissimilar to every other three-year-old. Plus, my theory is that so long as she's dressed to get dirty, the way small children are meant to, no one will notice that I haven't the first clue how to do her hair. But a fact is a fact, and I can't deny this one. In the past month or so, Quinn has become increasingly difficult for me to dress. Every morning for a month, the first conversation I've had with her has sounded like this.
"Daddy, I want to wear a party dress."
"It's cold outside. Brr, you should wear pants."
"I don't want to."
"But I'm wearing pants," spoken cheerily.
No, I hate you.
With which she collapses howling in the corner of her closet, forehead pressed into the carpet like a Muslim at prayer. It's been an odd experience. Quinn has, throughout this difficult period, acquiesced happily to her mother's aesthetic judgment, but the moment I walk into her dressing room, she revolts. If it's 45 degrees and foggy, she insists on wearing a skimpy dress. If it's 80 degrees and sunny, she demands wool tights. When a day calls for pants and a t-shirt, as every day does in my view, she calls for her hula dancing costume and hollers until she gets it. By my lights, she is wildly unreasonable. By the lights of the women in her life, her mother and her teachers, she has finally and justifiably decided to resist my incompetence. I have a tendency to prove, at least to myself, that whatever I happened to do in any given situation was exactly the right thing to have done. Small penis syndrome, my wife now calls this. This time, I surrender to a force greater than my opinion and try a new approach.
I want to wear a party dress.
Sure, pick a dress.
Okay, Daddy. And Daddy, I want to wear Mama's lip gloss.
Sure.
Great, Daddy.
And from there, it couldn't have gone more smoothly, except that the party dress hangs awkwardly, the lip gloss winds up as face paint, and her hair remains far outside my abilities to cope with. The truth is, Quinn doesn't look any better than she did when I muscled her into pants and a t-shirt. The origin of vanity is not the desire to be admired by others, but the need to be in charge. The other thing just follows from it. I once went to visit Roald Dahl at his home in the English countryside. The author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach, and other macabre tales for children had just publicly denounced the satanic verses as an irresponsible piece of self-promotion. He didn't exactly endorse the fatwa that had just been issued against Salman Rushdie, but he came close, and I used this as an excuse to go and talk to him. He wasn't well. He was more or less confined to an upholstered chair and wasn't long for this world, but he could not have been better company. I remember next to nothing of what he said about Rushdie. What I recall was lunch. Several Dahls gathered, and a plate of ham cold cuts arrived at the table. Dahl said something about how closely the cold cuts resembled human flesh, and how he once thought of writing a story about children who were served cold cuts from the corpse of a missing friend. I expected someone at the table to complain, but instead, his daughter giggled and told a story about how she had witnessed, firsthand, a butcher slice off his palm while running a shank of ham over a meat slicer. She went on to describe, to the delight of the entire family, how the slice of butcher's flesh fit perfectly on top of the stack of ham, exactly like the ham we were about to eat. 60 seconds into the meal, the Dahls were vying to outgross each other with tales of severed limbs and pulsing pink flesh while happily munching ham sandwiches. With the possible exception of Mrs. Dahl, the entire family had preserved into adulthood a childlike delight in the grotesque. Once you have a small child, you can see the full appeal of the Dahlian imagination. To a small child, the adult world is grotesque. For a start, it's all ridiculously out of proportion. To a child, every grown-up is a monster. Then there are all these events that occur in the grown-up world that a child, in trying to get her mind around them, distorts wildly. I went out of town on business last week.
Are you going on an airplane?
Quinn asked before I left.
Yes, I said.
Are you going to an airport?
She asked.
Yes, I said.
Are they going to put chickens in your luggage?
She asked. I had to think about that one. Then it struck me. Check-in, luggage, chickens in the luggage. How strange the adult world must seem when filtered through the child's vocabulary. Even those aspects of the adult world designed explicitly to give innocent pleasure to a child are often, to a child, either weird or downright horrifying. Which brings me to Mickey Mouse. I had taken Quinn to a birthday party around the corner from our house in Berkeley. The highlight of the birthday party was to be the appearance of Mickey Mouse. Mickey was meant to be kept a secret. The children would gather and play for a bit, and then Mickey Mouse would burst through the doors and surprise everyone. But it's hard to keep a secret, especially a good one, from Quinn, as it is so tempting to use any prospective treat as a bribe. To coax her into her car seat, I had told her that if she ceased to struggle, she would get to meet Mickey Mouse, in the flesh. She seemed pleased by the idea. We arrived at the birthday party. Quinn overcame the shyness she always experiences when she enters a crowded room, and was soon playing with the other children. But there's no such thing as equilibrium in a room full of toddlers. Something bad is always about to happen, and what happened was that the father of the birthday girl came over to say there was a problem with Mickey. The company that farmed out Mickey to children's birthday parties had just phoned. Mickey was ill. The company had called around looking for a substitute. They had found one, but he lived 6 hours away. He was on his way, but he'd be late. You had to admire the commitment. In 6 hours, you can get from our house in Berkeley to Reno, Nevada. Some poor guy who lived, in effect, in Reno, had tossed his Mickey Mouse costume in the trunk of his car in the wee hours of that morning and was now hauling ass across the country to humor a room full of three-year-olds. And he wasn't even the real Mickey Mouse. He was an understudy. An hour or so later, Quinn was off on one side of a large deck, playing with a dollhouse. The other kids and adults mingled on the other side. I was munching a raw carrot and glancing across the deck every 4 seconds to ensure Quinn hadn't fallen off. Suddenly, onto the deck, between Quinn and everyone else, burst Mickey Mouse. He wore all the official gear, but still, there was something off about him. In the first place, he wasn't alone. Trailing him was a ghoulish assistant, clutching balloons and sweating so profusely that one of the children turned to his mother and said, "Mommy, the man went swimming!" Together, the two of them looked as if they had jogged, not driven, from Reno. But the real problem was Mickey himself. He wasn't the cute little Mickey you think of when you think of Mickey Mouse. He was a large man, stuffed into a small costume that didn't quite fit. His giant mouse head tilted this way, then that, as if partially severed. His white gloves failed to disguise the thick black hair on the backs of his hands. Even his black mouse slacks looked to be loners. Bending over hurriedly to greet the first child he saw, he flashed a rear vertical smile. The first child he saw was Quinn. I tried to imagine this scene from Quinn's point of view. The fact is that while she had pretended to be delighted that she was going to meet Mickey Mouse, she had never actually heard of the creature. God knows what she thought she was getting into, but it wasn't a 6-foot rodent with a greaseball sidekick. Instantly, so quickly that Mickey didn't have a chance to lay his hairy mitts on her, her face dissolved in terror and she began to scream. Not a playful scream, a Janet Leigh in the shower and psycho scream. I raced across the deck, clutched her in my arms, and spent the next 5 minutes consoling her. When she'd calmed down, she squirmed away from me and ran into the house.
"Where are you going?"
I hollered after her.
"To find Mickey Mouse," she said.
For the next hour or so, she enjoyed Mickey Mouse in a way that was new to me, and I assume also to Mickey. Mickey Mouse, to Quinn, was not an endearing character. He was a serial killer. This was Disney with a twist of lime. She'd sneak right up to him and then, when he noticed her, dash away screaming bloody murder. It was strange to see. Her mother and father can't bear scary movies, and I'll bet money that when she grows up she won't like them either. But in her current state of mind, she likes nothing more than the toddler equivalent of a horror flick. If she weren't so much like every other small child, she'd be considered insane. One of the many surprising things to me about fatherhood is how it has perverted my attitude toward risk. It is true that there are many kinds of risk, emotional, social, financial, physical. But I can't think of any I enjoy taking more than I did before I had children, unless you count the mere fact of having children as a kind of celebration of emotional risk. Otherwise, I'm rapidly becoming a wimp. There are little risk-averse things I do now that I never did before, and little risk-averse feelings that I have now that I never had before. To wit, item. The other night, Tabitha and I went to see Minority Report. It's the sort of movie that just a few years ago I would have cheered and Tabitha would have at least tolerated. But in the middle of the film, a small child is abducted from a public swimming pool. That was enough to ruin it for Tabitha and to make me feel we ought to just skip dinner afterward and go home and make sure nothing terrible had happened to our children. This is obviously neurotic. I don't know a single case of a small child being kidnapped at a public swimming pool in Berkeley, California, while her father holds his breath underwater, much less from her bed at night while being guarded by babysitters. But I am no longer rational on this subject. My emotions are easily manipulated by cheap dramatic tricks involving the suffering of small children and by the current media hysteria about what is, in fact, an ordinary rate of child murders. I think I could still sit through the scene in Richard III when the villain has the two little princes smothered in their beds. Anything closer to 21st century American life ruins my day. Item: I no longer enjoy rolling the dice in the stock market. I never enjoyed it all that much, but what pleasure I took in it vanished with Quinn's arrival, well before the stock market collapsed. With her arrival, for the first time in my life, I began to worry a bit about money. I have no reason to worry about money, but that doesn't stop me from doing it. When people talk about the mood in the financial markets, they tend to assume that the market drives that mood. But of course it doesn't, not entirely. A few years ago, a piece in the Michigan Medical Journal argued that the reason the internet bubble reached such ridiculous heights was that huge numbers of investors were now taking drugs that lowered their inhibitions. With a third of the U.S. investing population on Prozac or some other mood-enhancing drug, the paper concluded, it was no wonder that so many people believed the market would simply keep rising. Small children are also a mood-altering substance with financial consequences. Their effect on the human mind is the opposite of Prozac. At any rate, my own current financial taste for cash and bonds seems to be at least partly a response to parenthood. Item: I am no longer as open as I once was to helping out people I don't know, especially when those people need a bath. Several times a week, I have a vaguely hostile response to a stranger that I would not have had if I didn't have children. For instance, when I see a bum loitering in the park near our house. I find it less amusing than I once did when people knock on my front door to ask me to join some religion or sign some petition. I used to pick up hitchhikers every now and again, but I wouldn't think of doing it today. In general, the probability that I will extend myself to a stranger in need, always slight, is now zero. Item: not long after our first child was born, but well before September 11, 2001, I began to experience a mild fear of flying. There was a time in my life when I could, fairly blithely, hop out of an airplane with a parachute on my back. Now I can't get onto an airplane without melodramatic feelings of doom. When I travel, I carry pictures of my children for the sole purpose of having one long look at them the moment after the engine dissolves into flames and the plane enters its final dive. These occasional spasms of terror are as pathetic as they are undeniable. The only explanation I can come up with, other than that I've become a pussy, is that I can now imagine an elaborate narrative triggered by my tragic death. Before I had children, I had no particular reason to fear dying, because I had no particular notion of the consequences of my death. If I had died in some absurd accident, it wouldn't have mattered all that much. Now, because of the children who would be left without a father, and the wife who would be left alone to care for them, my life seems more important, even though in some respects it is actually much less important, having, as I do, fewer years to lose. I am aware that all these feelings are more or less nuts, but they are also more or less true. I know for a fact that my children are insane. Or, at any rate, I know that if an adult behaved as my children do, he would be institutionalized. Is it possible that they are contagious? When I came to, the first thing I noticed was that wherever I was, I had never been there before. Flat on my back, an oxygen mask on my face, I looked up and saw a silver wall, some flashing lights, and a man in a dark blue jumpsuit, his back to me. The mask made it hard to call out. I tried to raise my arm, but couldn't. My arms and my legs were strapped down, my head too. My gaze was directed straight down at my bare chest and the several wires taped to it. My stomach, I could see, was caked with blood. My khakis, too, were a dull, dry red. On the left side of my face, I felt the warm, pleasant drip, drip, drip of even more blood. Apparently, I'd been in some sort of accident. What sort? I had no idea, but I knew what I was meant to do from TV shows. I wiggled my fingers, then my toes. The man in the blue suit turned around and removed my oxygen mask. I now realized, again from TV shows, that I was in the back of an emergency rescue unit.
I can feel my toes and fingers, I reported knowingly.
What's your name? He asked. I told him, but my voice sounded strange and manufactured, not my natural own.
That's good, Michael, he said, and smiled with a terrifying condescension. This man knew something I didn't.
What?
Do you know what day it is? He asked.
I never know what day it is, I said.
He says he never knows what day it is, he said.
Out of the corner of my eye, I now spotted a second man in a dark blue emergency rescue uniform, and I remembered something. Quinn on an ice rink. I remembered skating over to her awkwardly, like a man pumping a razor scooter up a steep hill, and then skating back to my own beginner's ice skating lesson. I also remembered that they had lumped the beginners together with the intermediates. I remembered a short, squat Irishman showing me how to spin. I recalled thinking, if I try to spin, I'll kill myself. But what I couldn't remember was why I was ice skating in the first place.
Do you know your address?
I did, just.
Michael, you've been a little funny for some time.
I now recalled why I was ice skating. I was ice skating because Quinn's mother had conceived that the three of us should do something meaningful together. Just one thing to remind Quinn that she was still special. We cast about for one meaningful thing and landed upon ice skating. Tabitha knew how to ice skate, Quinn and I did not. Quinn and I would learn together, side by side, in that briefly harmonious spirit we had set off, presumably not long before, for the local ice rink. What I couldn't remember was why we needed to remind Quinn she was special.
Where are my wife and daughter? I asked.
They're outside in your car, he said.
Do you remember what kind of car you have?
I did, a bit more clearly.
How long have I been unconscious? I asked.
He didn't answer.
What year is it?
He asked.
A wave of irritation crashed over me. My head pounded. I didn't care what year it was, or what car I owned, or what I'd eaten for dinner. I had bigger problems, such as, who was I? Or rather, was I the same me as I had been before whatever had happened to me happened to me? I needed for the man to sit down and listen to my life story from the beginning to see if it all felt familiar. Then I remembered something else. The book! Before I fell on my head, I was writing a book.
Can you remember what year it is? Asked the emergency rescue worker. I told him what year it was. This time the answer came to me easily.
Do you remember falling?
No.
What do you remember?
I remember that if I don't hand in my book in 6 weeks, I'm fucked. He looked at me a little strangely.
Okay, he said. That's a start.
And so I told him about my literary problems. How thrilling it had been to be handed material so rich that I was limited only by my ability to handle it. How for months I'd been haunted by the sense that something would interfere with my finishing it. How a few months earlier, with about a third of the book done, the manuscript had been stolen, along with everything I had ever written and not published, including 15 years of private journals and biographies I had kept of my two daughters. How a fancy truck with darkened windows, it was spotted by a neighbor, had rolled up alongside my office in broad daylight. How its occupants had picked the lock to my office, stolen my computer, all my backup files, from a separate room, and nothing else. How they'd left no fingerprints, only a mystery. Then, by some miracle of brain chemistry, I realized I sounded like a lunatic.
I know this sounds nuts, I said.
This all happened?
This all happened, I said.
I explained to the man, who continued to stare calmly at me, how, I do not know, how my wife had understood, or pretended to, that to compensate for the loss of my manuscript, I needed to abandon most of my responsibilities as a father, how I had spent several months redefining what is meant by the bare minimum, how little a husband and father can do, and still not trigger screams of terror when he walks in the front door, how I had a genius for it, and an excuse, a deadline, how Dixie didn't seem to mind. A father doesn't add much to the life of a 6-month-old child. But that Quinn was different. The moment I put some space between me and her, she set about trying to drive her mother insane. She'd eat nothing but sugar, do nothing but watch cartoons. Denied sugar and cartoons, she took to calling her mother, "You stupid lady!" Told not to talk to her mother that way, she'd spit, absurdly, "Jackass!" Somewhere in there, she got her first bad report card. Her teacher said that the normally ebullient Quinn was now, occasionally, morose. On my brief visits home, I saw more truculence than moroseness, but that was as alarming in its way. On Christmas morning, the moment she realized that she'd ripped open her last present, she looked up and said, "Oh, shit!" Fucking hell, I thought. Where did that come from? When I spoke that last line, the ambulance man laughed.
"He's okay!"
he shouted out to his colleague. They changed their plan to drive me to the trauma center to determine if I'd suffered brain damage. Instead, they would drive me to the emergency room to have my head sewn up. Before they did, they invited Tabitha into the truck to tell me that she and Quinn would be right behind me in the aforementioned car. My wife is at her best in such moments. She's as good in a crisis as ice on a burn. After making it clear to me that I was a wimp to be concerned about the state of my brain, she said that I didn't need to worry about Quinn. She had hustled her off the ice before she could see her father lying in a lake of blood. It's astonishing how much trouble we take to prevent our children from seeing the world as it is. It's even more astonishing how, even when we might think we have earned a right to forget about our children for a moment, we haven't. The ambulance started. The siren wailed. I remembered another thing. Quinn needed to feel special because I had spent too much time working on my book. I was learning how to ice skate because someone had broken into my office and stolen my book. The theft of my computer memory had led to this assault on my own. The emergency rescue worker was back to fiddling with one of the machines hooked up to me. He seemed to think we were done talking. We weren't. My mind wasn't right, and I knew it wasn't right. I thought, when you hit your head and you are never again the same, how do you know? If you have that thought, does that mean you are the same? I didn't know, and I was certain the only way I would know was to talk and talk and talk. "I've got to finish this book soon," I said, a little desperately. "Uh-huh," he said. "No," I said. "I still have a problem."
"Yeah?
I can't remember what the book's about."
"Give me a moment," he said. He didn't even try to hide it. I was boring him. I was boring the emergency rescue worker. I must have fallen asleep, as the next thing I knew, I was looking up, not at an emergency rescue worker, but a lady doctor.
"I hear you're a writer," she said, making conversation. "What do you write about?"
She was soon sorry she had asked, for it was then I remembered. Baseball! I was writing a book about baseball. As she stitched me back together, I offered her, free of charge, my literary autobiography. Every last detail, including the occasional journal I'd been keeping of my family life. I told her, for instance, I'd written about the birth of my child, which had occurred in this very hospital. I told her I'd lived in Paris, and published some accounts of the experience. It was then that she perked up.
"I read those," she said.
Inexplicably, I felt better.
"I love those descriptions of you with your son in the Luxembourg Gardens."
"That was Adam Gopnik," I said. For the first time, I felt something I knew I had always felt. The surge of irritation, the choking back of indignation. Oh, the horror. Oh, the smallness of existence. Was so breathtakingly familiar that I couldn't deny it. I was still me.
Part 3. Walker. 2 had seemed like the right number to both of us, until we had 2, and even then it seemed sort of like the right number to me. 2 was always the plan. 5 years ago, at fantastic expense, with the view to maximizing our living space while giving each child her own room, we'd torn up a 4-bedroom house and made it into a 3-bedroom house. Then one day Tabitha began to shoot me long, soulful looks at night and say things like, "I just feel like someone's missing." She thought we should at least discuss the idea of having a third child, but of course all that meant was that she'd already made up her mind. It was up to me to prevent it, which is to say that it was only a matter of time before it happened. And that was that. Tabitha called the architect who had torn out the fourth bedroom and told him we'd be building an addition.
Beep! Beep! Beep!
To the shriek of an alarm, I awaken but don't move. What with the extra pillow and the warm blanket, the delivery room couch had proved surprisingly comfortable.
Beep! Beep! Beep!
Having witnessed childbirth twice before, I've acquired this expertise. I know that alarms on delivery room machines are nothing to fear. Along with smoke detectors and airport security machines, they belong on the long list of devices in American life designed to cry wolf. Apart from that, here is the sum total of what I've learned waiting for my children to be born. 1. Arrive sober. 2. Do not attempt to be interesting, as it makes the nurses uneasy. 3. Never underestimate your own insignificance. And 4. Try to get some sleep, as no one else can. Of course, it is important to be present and conscious for the birth of your child. To miss it would be to invite scorn and derision and lead others to speak ill of you behind your back. But up until the moment the child is born, the husband in the delivery room is in an odd predicament. He's been admitted to the scene of the crisis, but given no serious purpose. He's the Frenchman after the war resolution has passed. I had just pressed a second pillow hard over my head to mute the alarm. It sounded as if it might be coming from the painkiller pump, and was very nearly asleep when I heard a new voice. "You're 10 centimeters, it said. The last time they'd brought the chains out onto the field, they'd measured her at a mere 4 centimeters. 10 was clearly forward progress, but it had been nearly 5 years, and I couldn't recall how many centimeters there were in a first down. I rose on the couch, and in the unnaturally bright tone of a man pretending he hasn't just been asleep, asked, "So, how many more centimeters we got to go?" That's when I noticed we had a new doctor. She looked at me strangely. 10 centimeters means the baby's coming," she said. "Oh." She'd been in the room only a couple of minutes, as it turned out. Before that, Tabitha had never seen or heard of her, and, as the doctor now mentions, she's about to quit delivering babies and move to Detroit, so this is likely to be the extent of our relationship. "I'm Dr. Vey," she says, and grabs a stool and a mask. It's 4:23 in the morning, and the mood in the air, as far as I'm concerned, is giddy exhaustion. "I, Vey!" I holler as Dr. Vey moves into the catching position. "It's Oy Vey, honey," Tabitha says calmly. "Can you get the mirror?" I find the mirror. In Berkeley, no birth is complete without a mirror. The belief here is that the mother, as she grunts and groans, should have all 5 senses fully engaged and pumping meaning into the experience. The ideal Berkeley birth has probably never actually happened, but if it has, it happened far from civilization, in the woods, without painkillers or doctors or any intervention whatsoever by modern medicine. Along one side of the birthing mother was a wall of doulas wailing a folk song. Along the other, all the people she had ever known. At her feet, a full-length mirror in which she watched her baby emerging. At her head, a mother wolf licking and suckling. Incense-filled urns released meaningful, carbon-free odors. The placenta was saved, and if not grilled, recycled. Tabitha never wanted the full Berkeley, but back when we started, 7.5 years ago, she gave a passing thought to employing a midwife instead of a doctor, and thought that it might make the experience more meaningful if she skipped the painkillers. She picked out music and found scented oils with which to be rubbed. To the immense irritation first of her obstetrician and then of herself, she hired a doula who was meant to use said oils to massage her feet during the delivery, but instead went out for turkey sandwiches and never came back. That was 7.5 long years ago. With her slender build and narrow hips and her near total intolerance of physical discomfort, my wife was ill-designed for childbirth. The first time around, in this very hospital, she began to hemorrhage. The doctors saved her life, and with so little drama that we didn't realize what they'd done until well after.
The second time around, again in this hospital, they saved not only her, but our second daughter, who had entered the birth canal at a historically tragic angle. Entering her third pregnancy, my wife lost interest in doulas and incense. She longs only for painless, antiseptic, impersonal modern medicine. Numb is good. If they ran tubes underground from hospitals to homes so that painkillers could be delivered in advance of labor, she might well have been their first paying customer. Of the original Berkeley dream, the mirror's all she's got left.
"Can you feel the contractions happening?" the doctor asks. "Slightly."
She's lying, thank God. If she felt a thing, she'd be hollering.
"Beep, beep, beep."
The painkiller pump again. Another nurse appears, another stranger we're almost surely never again to lay eyes upon.
"Angie needs a break," she says.
Angie's the nurse who still hasn't worked out what's going wrong with the painkiller. Angie exits. Dr. Vey prods and pushes and massages and waits. Behind her, on the wall, is a small sign bearing the first words my child will see. "We strive to give 5-star service."
"I think you're having one now. Push."
Tabitha pushes, turns beet red, and goes all bug-eyed.
"Maybe you shouldn't hold your breath," I say helpfully.
No one notices. A single 30-minute nap, and I've lost what little right I had to be heard.
"Can you feel anything at all?" the doctor asks.
"Not really."
"Imagine you're trying to poop," says the doctor.
Worried that imagining might make it so, I retreat up and away from ground zero and stroke the tippy top of my wife's head. But this just further isolates me as the character in search of a role, the carrot in the school play. Out of nothing more than a desire to seem busy, I grab hold of one of Tabitha's legs and pull it backward. Then, like the master on a slave ship counting the strokes, I begin to chant. 1, 2, 3. I half expect the doctor and nurses to fall about laughing and tell me to stop, but they don't. I seem, in fact, to have written myself a speaking part.
1, 2, 3! 1, 2, 3!
Tabitha pushes harder. Her eyes look as if they are about to pop out of her head and ricochet off the ceiling.
Here it is.
There comes a moment when I cease to be able to watch the birth of what is presumably my child with anything but horror. This is that moment. It's meant to be a beautiful sight, a thing to be videotaped or at least remembered and played over and again in the mind. But it feels more like a hideous secret to be kept. But the damn mirror makes it hard to avoid. 10 minutes ago, there was no place to hide. Now, there is no place to look. Boy or girl? We didn't know. But girls were all we'd ever done, and we'd spent a lot less time arguing over boys' names than girls. She'd gone from Clementine to Penelope, to Phoebe to Scout, and then back to Penelope. At midnight, when the water broke all over the living room floor, we were just starting what I assumed would be a long creep back to Clementine. I like the sound of Penny Lewis, but Clementine made you want to sing.
"That's the best push yet," says the doctor. "One more time."
1, 2, 3. I feel like Richard Simmons in one of his videos.
"You can do it." 1 more, just like that.
1, 2, 3. Next comes the sound of a hairless dog escaping from quicksand.
It's a boy.
And with that, Walker Jack Lewis comes into the world. Once they wheel Tabitha from the delivery room to the recovery room, stage one ends and stage two begins. For the whole of stage one, a father performs no task more onerous than seeming busy when he isn't. Nothing in stage one prepares him for stage two, when he becomes, in a heartbeat, chauffeur, cook, nurse, gopher, personal shopper, Mr. Fix-It, sole provider, and single parent. Stage two is life as a Mexican immigrant, with less free time. Entering stage two, I know from experience, I have between 24 and 48 hours before I'm overwhelmed by a tsunami of self-pity. I set out to make the most of them. The first assignment is to fetch our 7 and 4-year-old daughters from home so that they can meet their new baby brother,
and see firsthand the joy of partial disinheritance. The birth is supposed to have put them into a delicate psychological state. As I enter the house, I see no trace of it, however, or, for that matter, of them. Just inside the front door lies the shrapnel from an exploded giant Reese's peanut butter cup. In the kitchen is the residue of what seems to have been a pancake breakfast for 20. Dishes long banished from use have migrated out of the backs of kitchen cabinets. Toys untouched for years litter their bedroom floors. Exactly 13 hours ago, at midnight, our kind and generous next-door neighbors left their own bed for ours so that we might go to the hospital and have a baby. Briefly, I have the feeling that if I turned around and walked away, my children would very happily use these new grown-ups to create a new life for themselves and never think twice about it. At length, I find them at play with their benign overlords in their courtyard.
"Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!"
they shriek. We embrace histrionically. They know where I've been, and they know their mother has given birth. But instead of asking the obvious question, "To what?" they race off to find various works of art they've created in the past 6 hours.
"You have a baby brother!"
I shout at their vanishing backs. A baby brother, as it happens, is exactly what they both claim to least want.
"A baby brother!"
they shriek. I've never been able to feel whatever it is I'm meant to feel on great occasions, so I shouldn't expect them to either. But of course I do. It's not until they climb into the minivan that they finally get a grip.
"Daddy?"
asks Dixie, age 4, from her seat in the third row.
"How does the baby get out of Mama?"
This minivan is new. I've never been in the same car with a person who still seemed so far away. In the rearview mirror, her little blonde head is a speck. I holler back what little I know.
"Daddy?"
asks Quinn, age 7.
"Yes, Quinn?"
"How do cells get from your body into Mama's body?"
We wheel into the hospital parking lot.
"Help me look for a parking spot."
That distracts her. They love to look for parking spots. In the Bay Area, looking for parking spots counts as a hobby. One day, when they are grown, their therapists will ask them, "What did you and your father do together?" And they will say, "Look for parking spots." We find a spot, and instantly the race is on to the hospital elevators, followed by the usual battle to the death to push the up-down button, followed by the usual cries from Dixie that because Quinn pushed the up-down button, she has first dibs on the floor button, followed by Quinn's usual attempt to push the floor button, too. Since not long after Tabitha began to balloon, they've treated every resource as scarce. One of anything has become casus belli. No object is too trivial to squabble over. A gummy worm vitamin, for instance, or a ripped pair of stockings. Produce in their presence an actually desirable object, an elevator button in need of punching, or, God forbid, a piece of candy, and you'll have screams inside of a minute and tears inside of two. Oddly enough, they used to get along. When the elevator doors open onto the third floor, all smiles, you'd never know how narrowly they'd just averted bloodshed, they come face to knee with Shirley. Shirley is the large and intimidating security guard assigned to prevent the 12,000 babies born each year in the Alta Bates Hospital from being stolen. She must be a success at it, as she's been guarding them even longer than we've been making them. This is the very same Shirley who, 7.5 years ago, prevented Quinn from being abducted at birth and thus spared some poor kidnapper years of sleep deprivation.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.